I want to introduce Dan Magala, who is going to be moderating today's White Sox panel, and then he'll introduce the players. One of the things about Dan is, if you know the 7-Eleven promotion that was done with the White Sox, where game time starting at 7-Eleven, well, that's all Dan. And actually, Dan is probably one of the few marketers, if not the only marketer, who's in the Hall of Fame because of that 7-Eleven promotion. So now you know one of the things that Dan's well known for. Dan is also the founding partner of Property Consulting Group, a Chicago-based marketing advisory firm. He's also designed some of baseball's most innovative revenue-generating concepts. And he's co-owner with Mike Veck of the Class A Fort Myers Miracle. And so now I'll turn it over to Dan Magala.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, and good morning, everybody. You know, the 7-Eleven for me, it's a, you know, we bring in all the revenue, so you know, Jerry can afford players like these, right?
Yeah.
To be able to bring in, should have negotiated a
just
slurpee.
In the Slurpees.
Yeah. Shows you I should have been a better negotiator and got a Slurpee machine for you guys, right?
Exactly.
But this is going to be a great session. You know, a lot of White Sox history in this hotel, in particular. You know, Roland Hemond, who I know we've celebrated the last couple days, historically set up camp here. You know, I think in the 70s, the amount of trades, the amount of dialogue that happened in this hotel, I think we're going to really add to the White Sox legacy here this morning with these three guys. And we'll somewhat hop right in and we'll get to know these guys throughout the morning. But Ron, I'll start with you. You know, even on this legacy of the hotel, you were telling us a story, you know, when you first got the call to join the White Sox, and you started at the Palmer House.
This was my first stomp. Got called up in 82 from Edmonton. I flew in. They gave me a room. No exaggeration, I think my room was this big. I mean, it had two or three other side rooms in it and beds in all of them, old-time pictures. So what did a local kid from Gary, Indiana do? I called my buddies. They came down. They spent the night. We went to Rush Street, you know, then it all started, 1982. But, you know, the oldness, I mean, this is such a pretty place. But now those rooms that I've stayed in here before, and we have also, they're like, you know, mini rooms now because they got 10 of them there. But it was just my first experience here.
Yeah, and Ron, actually, the hotel manager called. They're still an outstanding bill.
That could possibly be, I'm telling you.
So sneak out the exit on the way back. So, and then, you know, Mike, you were a local kid coming up to the White Sox, you know, Northwestern, shorter trip. You're on, obviously, from Gary. But what was that experience like when you first got the call for the White Sox?
For me, it was a very unique experience because I was with the Cleveland Indians, and they were in the midst of making a whole bunch of trades, not very good, 91, but I had family in Seattle, so I took a bunch of them out to lunch, came back to the room to get ready to go to the ballpark, and the light was flashing. And as I reached down to pick up the phone rang. As I picked it up, it was John Hart from the Cleveland Indians saying, "Mike, I need you to go to Mike Hargrove's room, the manager. You've just been traded." And the immediate, "Oh my gosh, I suck. These guys don't want me anymore? What was that all about?" I later found out they had an inside track on another kind of fast outfielder. You may have heard of him, Kenny Lofton. Pretty good trade on their part. But those emotions of you know, I can't believe I'm getting traded and didn't know to who. I pick up the phone just kind of in a phase. Click the buttons. What's the voice message? It was Dan Evans from the White Sox saying, "Michael, we are so excited. We have just traded for you." And all of a sudden, to go from an incredibly low to this high, coming back to my hometown, kind of like Ron, I'm on the north side where he was the south side. But to be in Chicago was just incredible.
Yeah, and then Carlos, you were a Birmingham, Alabama kid, and going through the draft process of being drafted for the White Sox. Walk us through that first moment when you got the call and certainly being drafted.
It was 66? I think it was the second year of the draft, I believe. The White Sox called me, I was drafted number one. And I didn't know what to say. But the guy came to sign me, but they didn't want to offer me no money. It didn't sound right. So I held out for a day. They came back and offered me, I think, $21,000. So that was a lot of money for me back in coming from Birmingham. So I was in awe. And I went to the rookie league that year and had a good year to send me to the Florida State League. I flunked. I hit 175 down there, I believe. And other than that, it's just stemmed from there. Got a decent career, and I'm very happy.
Yeah, and Carlos, from that moment till your first at-bat at Comiskey Park, walk us through that that timeline.
It wasn't good. I faced Dave McNally. He broke my bat twice. But like I said, but you learn from your experiment. I learned to hit him as I grew older and grew more mature. And but you know, the big leagues is a heck of a place to play. You know, you learn. It's a learning experience every day, from at bat to at bat. And if you don't adjust, you fail.
Yeah, and Ron, you know, I mean, obviously, everyone in this room knows your accomplishments, your rookie season, and what that was like. But you know, that first at bat, right? You know, gaining that confidence. Walk us through really some of that first perspective, the first time you dug your heels into the batter's box at Comiskey.
Yeah, Tony La Russa gave me a lot of confidence. He pinch hit me in the bottom of the ninth inning with bases loaded and two outs. So excuse my language, but I called him a prick. But he was also my coach in the minor league, so Tony and I had good rapport. So I get up there, and I think Jeff Zahn was pitching. Remember him? I mean, at one time he could throw hard, and he still threw pretty hard in 1982. And I had a good bat. Bases loaded. I hit a foul home run. I missed it by inches. Foul down left field line. Could have been the first swing, grand slam. I wound up getting 3-2. I fouled off 7-8 pitches, and he threw me a 3-2 changeup, and I swung and missed for strike three. You know, then I called Tony some other names. I said, Tony, you didn't know I was on Rush Street all last night. I'm a little tired right now. No, but, you know, and Charlie Lau was the hitting coach. He comes back to me. He said, son, that might have been one of the best at-bats I've ever seen. He says, you will be driving Cadillacs and Mercedes. Just keep swinging hard and don't worry about anything else. So that was my first at-bat in the big leagues.
Yeah, and then, and Mike, maybe since this is a White Sox crowd, that first White Sox at-bat, you know, when you approach it, obviously with great Chicago heritage, probably the heart's thumping a little faster, I'd imagine.
Well, unlike Ron, Jeff Torborg was the manager at the time, and he was smart in that my first experience with the White Sox was to go in and play defensively. We were winning a game. It's like, get out there in right field for Pasqua and run anything down. And in that first game, we were playing the Brewers at the time, and lo and behold, guys on first and second, two outs, eighth inning, and Molitor hits one in the gap that I got a good jump on, good beat on, ran, dove, caught it for the second out, flipped it to Lance, he threw it in, and then Figgy got the third out. So it was a great experience, the first for me getting on the field in the new Comiskey, not the old Comiskey. Did not have the pleasure of playing in there. But I jump in. My first at-bat, unlike Ron's, was with the Dodgers. And again, everyone's saying, hey, Lasorda likes to put rookies in. So fifth, sixth inning, go down in the tunnel and take some swings. We're playing the Braves. Glavin against Ramon Martinez. And Ramon gives up a home run in the first inning, and the game goes on and still 1-0. Bunch of the guys go down. The veterans here, Huff, follow us, take some swings. Eighth inning comes along, still 1-0, and Ramon's batting second. I'm all ready to go. Got the gloves, got the hat, got the name on the back. I'm in the big leagues. I'm going to get a chance. And all of a sudden I hear, you know, Anderson, Dave Anderson, you're hitting for Ramon. So I take off the helmet, take off the gloves, go get a drink, sit back down, and all of a sudden I hear this, Huff. I'm like, what? They go, Huff, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm living the dream. What? And they're like, you're hitting. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Anderson's hitting for Ramon. They're like, no, you're leading off. You're hitting for Socha. And I'm like, okay, where's my helmet? Where are my gloves? Where's my bat? I find them and I start scrambling down the dugout, and I hear one coach going, all right, it's Glavin. He throws hard, soft. And I'm like, the next guy comes along, hey, it's Glavin. He throws inside, outside, high, low. The next guy, hey, it's Glavin. It's Glavin. He throws a curveball, fastball, changeup, slider. And I'm just like, okay. So I get to the on-deck circle, and I grab the pine tar, and whoo, there goes the ball to second. Okay, grab the bat, one swing, literally run into the batter's box, and I'm getting the batter's box nice and clean. I hear the umpire going, hey, kid, get out of the box. And I'm like, what? And he goes, kid, get out of the box. And I'm like, what? And he goes, kid, get out of the box. I haven't announced you yet. And I'm like, Northwestern degree right there, okay. Step out of the batter's box. Umpire looks up, points to me, and then I hear that, now batting number 45, Michael Huff. And I can only imagine Glavin looking at me like, what a goofball. So first pitch, he just throws this little lollipop curveball for right over the middle, and I'm like, cracked, base hit. So I got a base hit in my first at bat on the first pitch. And I'm sure he's looking at me at first base cursing like, every rookie looks for a fastball. What are you looking for a curveball for? So
it too easy, right?
Yeah, I'm like, I should have quit right there. Batting 1,000, should have stopped.
Walk off. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's fascinating in talking to ball players, and these three guys are all alike, right? You know, it's kind of like remembering your first kiss to a certain degree. You know that first at bat, you know, to a T, it's frozen in time, right? And that you're able to really talk about each of those pitchers that you face, the movements and everything, and, you know, like it's frozen in time. Shows you the concentration that it really takes to be successful at that level. You know, Carlos and Ron hadn't played at the old Comiskey. You know, the we hear all the romanticism, right, of walking out onto a big league field and the grass and what that must feel like. Beyond the at-bat, what was it like the first time playing in the old ballpark? And maybe some memories, you know, I know a lot of longtime Sox fans in the room, but when you think about maybe a memory or two from the old ballpark, what comes to mind?
I don't know. Just, you know, from the minor league to the big league, it was just, I don't know, just driving a Bentley to a Pinto. You know, it was, you know, the grass and everything. We had Roger Boss's father, Gene. The infield was just flawless. You know, down a bad hop and everything. It just amazed me, you know, from coming where I came from, especially from down south, you know, playing cow passes and jumping over cow dung and stuff, catching baseball. So I was just...
Hey,
man,
I'm a minor league baseball owner. Be careful.
Okay? I'm sorry. But I was just, like I said, I just had a great time in the big league. I was like a kid. Like you said, the first kiss, yeah.
Yeah,
but it was nice.
For me and the old ball, I'm a local guy. I grew up in Gary. I watched Carlos play. Great career. Good friend. And getting just a chance to play. I was ironworking for a living. In 1976, I graduated. My dad gave me a piece of paper that says, you're an apprentice ironworker for American Bridge. Well, I wound up working, I think, 9 months straight, 14-hour days. So I made $72,400 out of high school. 1982, I get to the big leagues, I made $30,000. You know, something just wasn't right there. But and I never really had favorite players. I just like playing the game. I work for the White Sox. I can't go to the game and watch it. Don't get me wrong there. He brought it up. I can tell you every single at bat, out, strikeout, single, foul ball that I hit and pretty much every one of my teammates hit. I can't remember your phone number if you tell me 2 minutes earlier. But this head is so full of useless stuff. It's unbelievable. But just going out there and just getting, you know, a chance to walk out on the field and have all your friends and family from Gary, Indiana, drive over 20 minutes to see you play, it was pretty doggone cool. But I was more proud that my dad was there my first day to be there and be part of my career.
And dad, Sox fan, I take it?
My dad had the TV on, he had the radio, and he had a scorebook. And my dad passed in 92, so I was going through some old stuff the other day that Jerome Holtzman, Hall of Fame writer, gave my dad in 1982 a scorebook. You know those ones that are about this, you need a dolly to carry the shit around with you? And my dad did all my games. He was doing the Cubs games. I mean, he did everything. And he was an iron worker. He loved baseball. And I got to show Carlos this because he hit a home run and my dad, you know, made a fancy 5-point star onto it, you know. Yeah. And I really don't care what I did. I swear I do not. But it was just, it's just cool, you know, because you're watching TV. And I grew up in Gary, so WGN was on. I grew up more of a Cubs fan. You know, come 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, I was burnt out. I went to bed. I didn't watch Sports Vision, you know, but putting a uniform on was pretty doggone cool.
Yeah, and then, and Mike, for you, obviously in the new park, right? Yep. You know, what we're 2 years into the new stadium, 93-team wins the division, new era of White Sox. What was that moment like? We're really bridging generations, you know, but for a lot of people in this room, I mean, that was just such a tremendous season.
Well, and I'm sure you'll hear from, you know, like the 83 teams and the teams before. The ones that really won and were successful, everybody seemed to care about each other. And you kind of had three or four little pockets of people, you know, Ozzy and Joey, kind of the Latin players, and you had Bo and some of those guys, and you know, Tim Raines, Lance Johnson. But for the most part, you had a core that was based around the four first-round draft choices of Jack McDowell, Robin Ventura, Frank Thomas, and Alex Fernandez. And we would go out afterwards. We would go talk baseball afterwards. We would sit in the clubhouse. I mean, Carlton Fisk was still in there lifting after we all had eaten and talked to the reporters. And it's like, all right, yeah, if Carlton's still going, we got to keep going. Guys like Kit Kat and Carlos would come by. And, you know, it was kind of like the wives or the girlfriends knew, you know, you're not staying and waiting for us. You know, you're going home because we're going to keep talking baseball and we were going to care about each other. And like you said, being a local boy, it was great, you know, every time I had a chance to give Tim a day off in left or Lance in center to hear at least one, you know, like, go New Trier or go Northwestern or welcome home. So, you know, thumbs up while I'm focusing. But, it, you know, the new Comiskey was not quite the mystique of the old one, but that 93 team, very special.
I think that 93 team, right, set the tone for the new era of the new stadium, right?
Yeah.
You know, to be able to bridge that. And, you know, what's I've been around a lot of different Major League Baseball organizations, and what's really special about the White Sox is, and you said it, Mike, the legacy and the compassion that the players, not only in the current locker room, have for each other, but the generational gap, you know, as well. And I think that's something maybe fans don't get a lens into as much as you all do. But Mike, you know, I think you know, some of the stories of the players you've worked with behind the scenes, you know, in kind of you know, that are part of the White Sox legacies, would love some insights, you know, into a story or two of maybe some behind the scenes training that you've done to get some perspective that really shows that legacy of compassion for the White Sox.
Well, some of those stories we can't say in public. I hope you can understand. But as Dan's talking about, there wasn't a person in my 3 years here that didn't go above and beyond helping others, whether it was someone that was taking your job like Figgy would do for Roberto Hernandez. You know, clearly an heir apparent closer, but Bobby was more than willing to talk to him. What's the mindset? They would play catch and warm up before the games, and they'd be sitting together in the bullpen. For me, I got the phone call after the 93 season where, again, they had picked up Ellis Burks, and so there was even less playing time for me. I went actually back to the minors for a couple months just to play every day, and the call from Reinsdorf and saying, can you help someone this winter come down here and train at Comiskey? And I'm just like, you know, I went to Northwestern. Girardi lives up here. I live up here. We go work out with a team. Of course I'll help out, but could you tell me what you need? And he's like, well, I can't right now, but there is someone we want you to work with. And I'm like, work with? They go, yeah, we want you to teach someone defensively how to play in the outfield. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm like a defensive outfielder. I didn't get to play much last year, and you want me to teach someone how to take my job. Really? But for you, Jerry, of course. You know, can you tell me who it is? And he's like, no. And then a week later, that guy, Michael Jordan, wanted to play baseball. That guy I can work with. So.
And yeah. You did a poor job, too. Because if you saw that giant giraffe out there in right field, he couldn't do diddly squat, I'm telling you.
I got him playing basketball again, didn't I?
Yeah. You know, Carlos, you know, you played on some great teams in the you know, the early 70s. You know, the you know, the camaraderie of that club. What was it like? I mean, that must have been some crazy times in the clubhouse, in the dugout, and traveling.
Oh, we had a good crowd. We had Dick Allen. We had Pat Kelly, and we had that's a nuclear great guy, Eddie Herman. We had a funny clubhouse. We had it was kind of stories that kind of hard to tell, but Pat Kelly was a gas passer, you know. And me and Dick would just sit there, and between me and Dick, we would tell him, we would give him money to buy a salad. You got to get your salad. But stuff like that, you know, which was fun to us, and Jay Johnson was there pulling jokes and stuff, pranks. But when we played ball, between the line, we played hard. After the game, you know, like on the road, we'd sit in the bar, and a lot of guys sit down, you have a cocktail, but we talk baseball, you know. And it was just a camaraderie that you have, you know, being around the guys. I just enjoyed it. When I left the game for Sears 77, I wasn't missing baseball. I missed being around the guys, you know. And I had a bad first wife, so I enjoyed being on the road, you know. It was a luxury to me. But I had a great time. We had a great nucleus, a great bunch of guys.
And Ron, I mean, the camaraderie, I mean, I think that 83 team is just entrenched in our mind, right? And some of those champagne moments and just the love and the chemistry of that club. What was it like, you know, being on the road with those guys? What's a story or two, you know, to share of what that team was like off the field?
Well, I caught in the minor leagues when I first got drafted. Mike Socia, I signed with the Dodgers originally. Mike Socia and I were one and two catchers. He signed for $65,000. I signed for $5,000. You know, I knew who was going to catch. So when I got to the big leagues or climbing the ladder, they said, what position? And I said, I want to catch. And La Russa said, no, we just signed Fisk for 6 years. You're not going to catch. I said, I'm better than him. And I was at that time. And he goes, well, what's your next position? I go, first base. He goes, well, I got to take Greg Walker, my best friend in the game. He can't throw, so he's got to play first. So I never played the outfield until I got to the big leagues. And in old Comiskey Park, it was probably worse when Carlos played. The lights were horrible. Yeah. I mean, you can just stand there, and if you remember that one game where Carlton played left field and the ball hit him in the ear on the first pitch, and, you know, then he flipped off Hawk Harrelson for being general manager, send him out there. You know, I mean, you couldn't see in the old ballpark because behind home plate, if you remember the old ballpark, it sank down about 3 feet.
It did. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're looking at white T-shirts sitting in the stands all game. You're not even seeing the ball. It was tough, but we had Hoyt, Bannister, Dotson, Burns. I mean, we had a pitching staff that was phenomenal, and they had fun. But one thing Tony did with Bull and the rest of the team that we had, Harold Baines, we would have team parties. And I was just talking about this the other day, and we joked all the time. We always had a party where we'd get in there, we'd start talking baseball, then we'd just start making fun of everybody. So we're in Toronto with an off day. And we're staying in the high-rise in Toronto, Weston or Hyatt, I can't remember what it was. But they have those little skinny vent windows. You ever seen about 3-4 inches? You can open them up. So one of the guys went out and bought a scale, you know, like a weight scale, you know, a white one. So we set it there, and we were getting Mark Kill, Lamar Hoyt, and Bull to stand on the scale. So Mark Kill was our backup catcher, and honestly, he's probably one of the best catchers I've ever seen in the game. He just couldn't hit this water bottle if it was in front of him. So he gets on the scale, and it goes, U.S. patent pending. It went beyond the 300 mark. So then all of a sudden, everybody started busting chops, and we're eating and having cocktails. And we have tons of food up there, hors d'oeuvres. So Lamar gets on there, and U.S. patent pending. So at that particular time, we ordered pizzas. So Bull gets on there, and we just had all these boxes of pizzas delivered with everything minus anchovies. Well, every one of them had anchovies on it. So Bull started throwing these pizzas out of the 30th floor without the box. So we'd take the box and shake it, and the thing would frisbee down there. They were sticking on cab windows, you know. So obviously the...
What, manager?
No, the Toronto police. What do they call them?
The Mounties.
Mounties.
They came up there. on the top floor, and everybody's in there just, who threw the pizzas out? Somebody came in here, Bull said, and threw them out. And, yeah. So they understood what was going on. We had to go down there. All the rookies had to go clean them up. But, you just never knew what was going to happen. And when I talked to these guys earlier, and we probably did the same thing. I didn't care if they liked me. I really did not. But they knew when I went on the field, I was going to give you 110% of everything I had out there. You know, because everybody beats to a different drum. And it was fun. And I wanted to be the hero every single night. I didn't want anybody else to be the hero. I wanted to be it. And we all know in life, you're the goat more than you are the hero. But you have to have that attitude to go out there to succeed. And, man, I was a goat so many times. You know, and that's the part of it. You know, you got everybody's back out there. And it, like Harold Baines. Everybody knows who Harold Baines. He's like, what, a couple hundred hits shy of 3,000? I would give him all my hits to get him to the 3,000 mark. That's how much I love that guy. And he never had a cocktail with anybody. You never see Harold drink a cocktail out in public unless he's with me. And Jerry Reinsdorf asked him one time, he goes, Harold, how come you only drink when you're around Kitty? He goes, because I know if shit happens, he's got it covered. You know, Harold's like protective, and I think I was Harold's bodyguard. That's what I was. And Carlos was Dick Allen's bodyguard.
Yeah, and on, well, one, I don't know if I ever want to be in a hotel with you, right? After all these stories. But Carlos, we got a great round of applause when you mentioned, Dick Allen, and Ron just mentioned, you know, the relationship that certain players have, a lot of fondness for him in this room. Give us some perspective of what it was like to be not only a teammate of his, but a friend.
I was honored. You know, when he came over, he taught me how to play the game. He was a great base runner. People don't really realize that, but he was one of the better base runners in the game. He taught me for his stealing on pitches and stuff, getting jumped and stuff. And we used to go in his room and get a bottle of scotch and just sit around to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning just drinking, talking baseball. He teaching me for his setting up pitches, hitting, you know, hitting behind the runners and stuff. And I learned a great deal from him. He was a great ball player. I think he was just misunderstood. But he was a great guy, great teammate.
Yeah, and Mike, on the teammate thought, we talked about the Michael Jordan experience that you had. So, basketball to baseball, you also had an interesting experience with a football player with the White Sox as well. Can you give us a lens into that experience?
Yeah, well, again, 91 got traded over. 92, if you recall, we traded that really skinny, fast Latin guy, Sammy Sosa, up to the north side to get George Bell to protect guys like Frank and Robin. And then we picked up that guy from Kansas City, Bo Jackson. And at the end of 92, had the hip replaced. And in 93, when he was back, and the days that he would get a chance to play out in left field, if we ever had a lead, third at bat, I would be the guy that would go out there and play defensively those last couple innings. And more than a few times his third at bat, he would either get a hit or a walk, and I'd go out and pinch run for him. And I remember vividly one of the reporters after one of the first times that I pinch ran for him, you know, asking that innocuous question. So for the tremendous athlete you were, what does it feel like to have someone pinch run for you? And, you know, there was that, yeah, it's a little strange, a little awkward, and then he kind of like, without thinking about it, said, I know there's some Negro League players rolling over in their graves having a white guy pinch run for a black guy. Oh, but Huff is like really fast, and he's like a really good outfielder, so it's okay.
I mean, even that, right, that's a good look at even just at the camaraderie and the sense of humor, right, that, 162 games is a long season where you want those moments, right, of levity to be able to do it. You know, Ron, you know, I think all the White Sox fans that have been, you know, around you, know your sense of humor and your outlook. Give us an insight into maybe a moment where teams going through some, tough times or the monotony of the season, and humor brought some levity, to it. Because I think fun, humor, that level of perspective is a large key of the success when, you know, the three of you guys dig into the batter's box.
Well, I got two little stories, but First one, we have this number 35 for the White Sox, the big skirt. It wasn't the big hurt. It was the big skirt. Here's a guy that's 380 pounds, dodged baseballs like they were hand grenades when he batted. I said, Frank, you're so damn big, let the ball hit you, pick it up, and eat the damn thing. And that's true. So, you know, and I was on the team in 91. Remember when Nolan Ryan kicked the daylights out of
Ventura?
You know, that's the only hit Robin ever got off Nolan Ryan. It was on his head. So it's all fun. So when Frank gets to the big league, I'm out in center field. You're taking your turns hitting. And I never wanted to be in Carlton's hitting group because he was so slow that you would only get 9 swings, where if you were in somebody else's group, you'd get 50 swings. So Pudge is done hitting. I'm done hitting. And this big, young, strapping giant comes out there, Frank Thomas, and he wraps his arm around Pudge and I like this. He goes, you got any advice for an up-and-coming rookie? And I go, yeah, you see that guy over there? And I'm pointing at first base, and Roger Bossard was moving the screen for batting practice over there. I said, tell him every time you play first base to put the screens behind you, because I've seen you take 2 ground balls every single day and you hit for 1 hour. So I know you can't catch. I pretty much hit that on the head, didn't I? But just a good guy. But that day when Nolan thumped Robin, Bo runs out of the dugout, and he does a Superman fly, like, on top of the pile. And at that particular moment, it just evaporated. Nobody was there. So Bo does a belly flop on the mound, and he's, like, bouncing. And lo and behold, who's in the dugout? Did you know this? Frank Thomas was sitting in the dugout, hitting 350. He didn't want to get hurt. So Bo and I, after the fight, we went in there and pounded on Frank. I said, are you the kidding me? I mean, your team is getting thumped out here, and you're in here worried about your batting average. But, you know, God bless him. He got a Hall of Fame, and he's changed his attitude. But Joey Cora, second baseman. You know, and I'm coming up, and I'm blatantly honest. If you can't handle the truth, don't ask me a question. I'm just telling you right now. So, Joey, there's a ground ball. I'm playing first, a ground ball to my right. And Joey can get it, and he doesn't dive. So they throw the ball in from right field, and I get it. And he's not even getting a relay. So I have the ball in my mitt, and I go whack, and I thump him upside the head. I said, listen here, little shit. You cannot hit, but you can field. You can dive. You know? You can dive. That's how you're going to stay in the big leagues. And it came proven fact. He became a very good defensive person. He still couldn't hit. But he did what he did. So Ozzy's yelling at me, you cannot hit him. I said, Ozzy, I'm going to hit you. So we're playing the Blue Jays at the time. And George Bell's on first base, and I'm holding him on, and I'm bouncing him off. And Hibbard was pitching. Greg Hibbard, really? Little lefty. So we pick George off. I get the throw, and I swung around for the tag because I ain't got no chance to reach in front. And I hit George in the nose, and blood just went everywhere. I mean, and George stands up like this, like he's going to get me and beat me up. And Cito Gaston runs in front of him, and he goes, George, you're going to get hit harder the second time if you mess with that big guy. So we get to the 8th inning, and Fred McGriff's hitting, and I'm holding Willie Upshaw on first base. And everybody knows Freddie McGriff, crime dog. I mean, that boy can hit. So he gets up there, and he hits this ball so hard, it hits the dirt, hits the back of my glove. I didn't even get my glove turned around, and it goes up in the stands. And I get an error on it. I go, holy shit. I said, I didn't even see the damn ball, and I'm screaming at him. You know. So, and I go to Hibbard. I go, Hibbard, you throw that weak shit. Excuse my language, but that's how the story goes. I said, you throw that weak shit outside. And Ozzy go, oh, no, no, no. He goes, they hit it to shortstop. I want to have more children. I mean, that's this is all in the middle of the game. So Torberg runs out there, and he goes, what are you yelling at my players for? I almost got killed. I said, I got seam marks on my wrist. The ball's in the stands for a ground rule double. What the hell? You know, and I said, throw it to short. Ozzy goes, no more, no more. But that's the fun, you know. Because there's a lot of camaraderie on the field, too, that you talk about. Like, you make a diving catch. Like, if he would have made a diving catch and he's sucking gas, I'm making fun of him. You know, I ain't saying great catch. Shit, that's his job. That's his job, you know, and we're supposed to do that. But I had a nice time, wonderful career. I played with the Yankees, and, you know, I can go on all day and tell you stories about different teams like this. But can I tell you my Dave Righetti story?
Absolutely.
So I'm with the White Sox, and Dave Righetti strikes me out 4 times at Yankee Stadium. And he struck out 18, so I was the only one that struck out, right? You know, whoom! I mean, he was throwing hard and nasty. So all the reporters come up, you struck out 4 times in a ball game. I said, there's guys washing cars that probably struck me out 4 times in a game. In New York, you know, that's what it says in the headlines in New York the next day. We're flying out of town. So I get traded to the Yankees. A couple of years later, and Ron Guidry cut that headline out and put it in Dave Righetti's locker. So I walk over there, Rags grabs my arm, he walks over there, and he points up to the top, and there it was. Kittle says, guys washing cars, strike them out 4 times, just like Dave Righetti, you know, and I'm saying, oh, I feel bad about it. So we're getting along really good for 2 years. '88, I go to Cleveland, and I haven't faced David for a long time. So game-winning situation, man at second, first and second, and I just broke my toe the game before off Tommy John throwing 43 miles an hour curveball on my big toe. And it just split my toe completely open. So I cut my spike in there so I could pinch hit against Righetti. That's my man right there. So, you know, and I first pitch, what's he do? He throws right at my bad toe. And I'm looking at him. I go, really? I'm hopping around. So the next pitch, he throws at my bad toe again. And I mean, Rick Cerrone's catching going, you know he's going to hit that toe. So, and I wasn't too dumb, you know. I think Joe Carter was hitting behind me. And so I knew he was going to throw something outside. So I hit a double. Left center field wall, got an RBI, second and third. But I really, I mean, hobbled into second base. Blood was gushing out of my sock. And so pinch runner, boom, boom, comes out there. Ronnie Washington was at the time, pinch ran for me. And I walked by the mound, Righetti's sitting there like this, and I hit him as hard as I could in the chest. And I said, you can't do that. My toe hurts, you know. And that's the camaraderie with other teams. So there's a Righetti story from the Yankees.
Yeah, no, it's and then Carlos, I mean, you have shared that lineage with Ron going White Sox to Yankees. What was that transition like?
I got traded the day after my birthday. Happy birthday, Carlos, right? Amazing. So I get to New York, I meet him in Cleveland. So I didn't play that night, so we go to Cleveland, go back to New York. So I'm on the plane, so I see the stewardess, she got a half a gallon of rum, half a gallon of scotch, half a gallon of something else. He had 3 or 4 different liquors. I said, Tag, I said, those coaches drink that much? He said, no, that's for us. And I knew I was in the right place. But, you know, everybody, like Billy Martin was the manager, so you know, I mean, he was alcoholic. And he made us alcoholics. And everybody drank and stuff. We drank hard at night and stuff and played and stuff, but we played hard. We had a great team in 76. We didn't have no home run. We really didn't have a home run hit our star. Shams, we had Shamless, Pinella, Thurman Munson. We had just a nuclear guys, just a little bulldog. 77, we got a Reggie, and that's another story. But we had just great games, and we had me and Mickey Rivers got the argument on the flight. I guess he was drinking beer or something, and he was something. He asked me about my IQ or something. And, you know, Mickey, he's kind of slow. And I said, you can't spell IQ. And that was his, Sparkle Lyle had a book, he wrote a book called The Bronx Zoo. He was in there. And that quote was in there from what I said. That, I mean, we just had some, oh, man, we had a time over there. But like I said, it was great. Like I said, I love Chicago, but over there, it was, I got some stories, but I can't tell them.
We got a couple of questions, you know, from the audience that submitted in the final 10 minutes or so we have. Mike, I'm certain one for you is someone that, you know, went to Northwestern and then played on the South Side. There's a question from the audience. As one of the rare Cub fans who also roots for the Sox, to what extent are the Sox players aware of the rivalry between the Cubs and Sox fans?
I think today's player, because it's such a different era where you're getting traded every 2 or 3 years, you're getting traded from the minor leagues to one organization to the other. Unless you're truly from the city, I don't think you can really grasp the magnitude of the rivalry between the two. I think every player that now is on the South side doesn't really think much about the Cubs. I think it's a different league. There's some interleague play, but you're so focused on winning your division. You're looking at how do I get to the playoffs? Now that there's a couple wild card spots, what are the little things that we need to do just to get there? That it doesn't really resonate until now you play those games that when I think all of us played when it was the Cubs Sox, it was just kind of for fun. You had minor leaguers playing the last couple innings. Now, again, unfortunately, it's just kind of a little bit of a different era.
What about, are you aware of the difference in the fan bases, too? Do you think, you know, there's a lot of Southside,
Northside.
There's
a huge difference in the fan bases.
This is probably the dividing line is the Palmer House, right? Geographically, maybe?
Pretty much.
Cubs fans have iPhones and send text during the game. Sox fans watch the game. Now, you can't boo me because I've had season tickets longer than anybody here at Wrigley Field, and I still have them. So, when I go to Wrigley Field, I watch the game because nobody else is paying attention around me. And if there's a foul ball, I don't want to get hit in the noggin by somebody who can't catch.
Except for that, how about that guy the other day? With the baby?
Yeah, just think if he had dropped that baby. My God.
Ron, a question for you from the audience. You know, I mean, those legendary moonshots that you hit at Comiskey Park, a question from one of the attendees in the audience. What does it feel like to hit not just a home run, but a rooftop home run? Are you aware of it, and what does that feel like?
You know, I really wasn't aware of it until I did it the first time. Then people started writing about it. You had to hit it 550 feet just to get it to the tip of the roof, that's a long way. And, you know, supposedly there's like Moose, if Moose Skyron was here, he'd say they moved home plate up. But I did it both when they moved it back and everything. So I did it 7 times. I went back to back with Bull one night. And Bull did a thing for Halo advertising. Remember with the Bulls on the back of the seats? They always had Halo. And they did a thing for home runs on the roof. He got 30 grand. He hit his third home run that day. So we're on a photo shoot on top of the roof. I have 2, he has 3. And he's holding a check for 30 grand. With 3 baseballs. Well, that night I hit one on the roof. So they took his 30 grand to back. So he wasn't very nice of me. But 23 people did it. I did it 7. Babe Ruth did it first. I did it the last. It's a home run. But my last home run I hit was very memorable. It was 28 degrees. And I pinch hit in the 8th inning against Pat Murphy for Boston. And Carlton and I did a little event the other night speaking. And he told the whole story. I didn't even say nothing. And he goes, there was only one fly ball to the outfield the entire ball game. It's one of those games where you got 3 or 4 shirts on and you can't swing. You got 2 batting gloves. And I come up and pinch hit, probably because I was so irritated I wasn't starting. I wasn't cold, but I hit it on the roof. And Hawk Harrelson, it's on live on radio. He dropped the holy shit on TV. He said, that man's not human. He said, now he's going to go climb, what is it, the World Trade Center in New York, like King Kong. But it's a good thrill. It's a great, great honor. There's a lot of big hitters that hit it up on the roof. Did you do it, Carlos?
No.
No, he was a sissy hitter. I'm just kidding. He's one of my favorite players ever, but it's a nice memory to have.
Yeah, do you, and on that thought, hitting a home run has got to be just a tremendous feeling at the big league level. But that extra level of really smoking one, do you know when you've got a little extra mustard on it, when you're running around the bases just kind of floating?
Well, I swung a 35-inch, 35-ounce bat. And, you know, it's like if you got a nail and you got to drive in a nail with a little itty-bitty hammer, it ain't going to work, so you got to get something big. Now they switch it around. Now they swing lighter stuff, but you can't feel it. I'm sure Mike and Carlos will tell you the same thing. When you hit a ball good, you don't feel it in your hands. It's just an extension of your arm, and you watch it. I think the fans got a bigger kick out of it than I did. And I honestly, there's not one home run that I ever sat and watched. When I hit it, I ran my ass off around those bases. And my teammates would yell at me, because I was embarrassed. My dad said, if the bird hit the ball hits the bird and comes in and you're not running hard, he's going to whoop me. So my whole life, I ran as hard as I could around those bases like it was going to be a triple.
Yeah, and Carlos, I'm thrilled someone asked this this question. You know, Mike Vec is a partner of mine. We've got Night Train working for the White Sox. Bill Vec's grandson is doing some tremendous things with the Sox. Fans in the audience are curious of your favorite Bill Vec story. And a second one, did you get to wear the shorts?
My favorite Bill Vec story was when I was out of the game. I was looking for a job. And I was trying to get to the Park District. And I said, I wanted to be a vet. And the guy said, well, yeah. I said, he lives in Hyde Park. And his number was listed. His number was listed. And that's you know, unheard of. Guy, you know, that magnitude and listed phone number. That you know, kind of tell you a little bit about Bill Vec. And the shorts, they traded me just in time. They wore them, I think, that in July or June of that year. I got traded in May, so I didn't get to wear them.
Yeah, so you're grateful for that trip.
Yes, I am.
That
yes,
was a birthday present, right?
Very grateful.
You know, speaking of birthdays and Bill Vec, you know, the lineage, and we'll ask you this question as part of this, Carlos, too. In my side of the business on, you know, fan-friendly promotions and everything, I don't know if a lot of people know, it was Bill Vec when he was with the Indians in the 60s that came up with the idea to actually put the players' last names on the jerseys as a way of fans to better understand, and you could understand Bill really believed the players were more than just numbers, right? So, you know, just an incredible influence of the many Bill Vec additions to the game and just sport. But, Carlos, you took that to the next level with your name and jersey number with May in 17. Yeah. Talk about how that happened and explain it. It's such a unique story.
I don't know. I went to spring training that year, and I had 29. My number was 29. And I came back that year. They brought me up in September. I led the league in Carolina. They brought me up September. I still had 29. But the next year, I made the ball club, and they gave me 17. And I, for some reason, I don't know why. And it came out, you know, my birthday, name, and birthday on the back of my uniform. A little trivia.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an amazing, I mean, just the uniqueness, right, of it. I think it's such a great legacy, you know, and just that connection with Mr. Vec as well, too, is great. We're nearing the end. We're in the bottom of the ninth, you know, and, you know, this session really was all about you. It's all about the tremendous White Sox fans and the legacy for these three guys. Thought we'd end on a question and, you know, for all of you to answer. You know, just maybe one anecdote of a touching moment that you've had with a White Sox fan through the years or what it's meant for you to really be part of this great legacy of the White Sox family.
I'll go first. It was speaking at, I think it was the first caravan, 91-92, back before all the fans came to one location where the players would go out in five or six vans with the broadcaster out into the rural parts of Northwest Indiana and around the Chicagoland area, and just getting to meet and speak with people, just connecting with them, and for them to hear a little bit of my story, I guess my greatest, I guess, remembrance of being a part of the White Sox family was, you know, 2 years later, 93, that family coming up and saying, you know what, you so impressed us with who you were, and we followed your careers, the ups and downs, the part-time player, but, you know, the perseverance that we've named our first child after your middle name because it was so unique. So now they didn't, born in Hawaii, my middle name is Kale, K-A-L-E, but they, I didn't say this to them afterwards, but they're like, we just want to take a picture of you and Kale. And I'm perfect. Thank you.
They were thinking vegetation.
Yeah.
Mine's a little bit stranger than most people.
Odd. Rod, saying a strange story? No.
I've always been friendly, and I really am. And I'll pretty much sign anything you got within reason, unless I'm eating. But coming up to the big leagues, I signed everything. Honestly, I signed all day, up and down the line. But you can sign 100 of them, you miss one, you're an asshole to that one person. So I know how it works. So in the picnic area at Old Ballpark, there used to be three or four girls back there that were 12, 13 years old that I would say hi to every day. They had Sox jerseys on. And all of a sudden, I became friends with them over the years. Well, one of them I am currently living with, and she is my lady, and Mike's met her, and so is Carlos. And she was 12 years old when I met her. And we took pictures together, and she never said a word. None of these women or girls ever said a word. And I'm friends with them to this day. I mean, I can call them now. They text me. And all they say is, he was just nice to me. You know? But there's a rule when I come to my house. I do not talk baseball. I will talk cutting grass, woodworking, steelwork, anything else like that. But You create a friendship, and I don't know if these guys consider me a friend or not, but every time I have my charity golf tournament and I invite them, they're the first ones there to help support me and all the money I've raised over the years for cancer, and I consider that a friendship. He knows I'll do anything for either one of these guys here. Greg Walker, I mean, most ball players can't do anything except play baseball. I tell her, I was a shitty ball player, but I'm a great carpenter, great steel worker. I can weld, I can cut anything. So I just keep busy, and I call it my OCD, but it's really CDO. It's OCD in the right order. And you throw in ADHD along with it, and 3 hours of sleep a night, I'm telling you, you can't keep up with me. So, and the only one I really like is my dog, Harley. So that's a good, a couple people here on Facebook with me. And I put a positive message every single morning on Facebook. And I don't hang around negative people. I really do not. And or greedy people. And I'll give you the shirt off my back if you're nice. But don't stomp me and say something bad about any of my teammates or my friends. And that's what life's all about. But these are two good guys right here. He's blushing.
I signed an autograph for a kid years ago. I guess my second, third year in the big leagues, and he was a baby. And I was signing an autograph at the ballpark in the scout lounge, and he came up and said, "You don't remember me?" I said, "He said, yeah, 40 years ago." I said, "Hell no, I don't remember you." You know, but he was the same kid I signed an autograph for, and to this day, you know, he always emailed me, text me. We have dinner and stuff, meat for lunch and stuff, and it's stuck. And I, you know, always relish that relationship.
No, it's and it shows you really the uniqueness, right, of the White Sox family. I'll close, the session that's been terrific. The number one White Sox fan that I knew is actually my grandmother, who, just grew up all the different generations that are here today. And I remember in 94... you know, when the work stoppage occurred, you know, she felt like a piece of her family was missing when she didn't have White Sox games. And I think that's the legacy that the three of you continue to bring, and sessions like this continue to evolve. So let's give these guys a great round of applause.
Thanks.
Good job.
Oh, yeah.